Good evening. Greg Barth back with another edition of Noir on the Radio. And joining me this time is Reed Farrell Coleman, author of the New York Times bestselling Robert B. Parker's Debt to Pay. Reed has written 25 novels, including 9 in the critically acclaimed Mo Progger series. He's a 3-time recipient to the Seamus Award for Best Detective Novel of the Year, a winner of the Barry and Anthony Awards, and 3-time Edgar nominee. He lives with his family in Long Island. You can find more information about him at reedcoleman.com. His latest work is titled What You Break and is available from Putnam Books. Reed Farrell Coleman, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Thanks for spending some time with us this evening.
Well, thanks for having me.
So Reed,
and,
if you would...
And Greg, one thing I have to say. I'm a four-time Edgar nominee. And I just lost for the 4th time. So well, you can look at it as I'm a 4-time nominee or a 4-time loser. And it's Mo Prager, not Prager. And I will promise to stop correcting you now.
Hey, no worries at all. I've got, I'll have to update the bio with the 4-time nominee and Mo Prager. Gotcha.
Prager.
So Reed. Prager, okay.
Right.
I will. So, Reed, if you would, tell us a little about yourself, your background, experience, the things that make you the writer you are today.
Oh, let's see. Well, I was born and raised in the Coney Island, Brighton Beach section of Brooklyn, New York. What makes me the writer I am today is probably too many drugs. No. I actually that's a difficult question to answer, but I'll try. I started writing poetry when I was about 12 years old. And why did I start writing poetry? I grew up in an angry household, you know, where we communicated by screaming at each other, basically. And, you know, when you live in a house where everybody screams at each other and communicates even their love through anger, you want to develop a way to be heard, because when everybody's screaming, nobody hears anybody. And I think I started writing poetry to be heard. And the poetry thing stuck with me all through high school. In fact, I stopped playing high school football to write poetry and to study, you know, take my English studies more seriously. I continued studying poetry in college and, you know, worked on the literary magazine. And I thought I'd do what many poets do or have done, which is to get a job and publish poetry. You know, poetry doesn't pay that much. You tend to get paid in copies when you get published in poetry.
Yeah.
Unless you can, you know, you're going to cook with those copies and use the extra fiber from the pages, you know, it's just, it was never going to pay the mortgage. And, you know, I had never read crime fiction. That's the funny thing. I know this is a long-winded answer, but I'm trying to give you a complete answer. So I had never read crime fiction. Crime fiction, to me, was always the cheesy books on my dad's nightstand with the lurid covers. I was a bit of a literary snob, and I obviously read poetry. I was a Vonnegut fan. You know, the only genre fiction I read was science fiction. And I had been working, you know, out of college, I'd been working at the cargo area, Kennedy Airport. If your listeners have ever seen the movie Goodfellas, those are the people I used to work with. And one night a week, I used to have to leave my job at the airport, which was in Queens, New York, and travel into Manhattan for meetings. And I had 4 or 5 hours to kill between the time I'd leave work and go to Manhattan. And I decided to take a night class, an English night class at Brooklyn College, where I'd gone to school, undergraduate school. And the only English class that fit my schedule was American Detective Fiction. And the first 3 books we read were The Continental Op by Hammett, Farewell My Lovely by Chandler, and The Maltese Falcon by Hammett. And I went to my wife and said, this is what I was meant to do. I just absolutely fell head over heels with crime fiction. And she said, yes, go ahead and do it. That was the second time she said yes to me. Both times she's regretted it. And I've been writing ever since. I've been writing crime fiction ever since.
Well, Reed, don't worry about the long-winded answers. We love this stuff. So please feel free to elaborate. Your latest release, What You Break, which is the second in the Gus Murphy series, follow-up to Where It Hurts. Gus Murphy is he's an intriguing noir character, ex-cop turned hotel, airport shuttle driver, kind of has a bleak outlook on things, dealing with depression, loss of a son, end of his marriage. He's kind of going through the motions, and it seems he uses work to distract from his mourning. How would you introduce Gus Murphy in this series to our listeners who may not be familiar with it yet?
Well, I like to think of Gus having been a guy you would love as a neighbor. I don't know how much snow you get in Western Kentucky, but here we get lots of snow. And there's always the guy on the street who, after he shovels his driveway, he'll look for the older person on the block or somebody who might need to, you know, help shoveling their sidewalk or their driveway. And Gus is that type of guy, not because he felt he should get a reward for it in this life or the next. He just felt is the right thing to do. So Gus is the kind of guy you'd love as a neighbor. He also was the kind of guy who he would describe himself as a guy who never had to lie a lot because he never wanted much. He sees people who lie a lot as people who want things either that are out of their reach or they don't deserve. So Gus has everything he wants in his life. He has a very attractive and loving wife. He has two almost adult children. He has a great pension. He's retired from the Suffolk County Police Department. He has a house, and he thinks he has it made. You know, most people who have the things they want, they think they understand how the universe works. Why else do they have the things they want? And Gus believes that right up until the minute his son dies playing basketball of an undiagnosed heart arrhythmia. And so his whole world blows apart. So Gus goes from being this guy who thinks he understands the world and has everything he wants to, you know, one split second later feeling he doesn't understand anything and that all the things he has somehow are now tainted and gone.
A lot of depth to this character. You know, it strikes me that as a PI, Gus is trying to find answers for others, yet the tragic irony is that he's unable to solve for some of the personal pains in his own life. Would you say that his PI work stems from him previously working as a cop, or is it more of an effort to kind of reclaim that order in a life where things outside of his control seemingly happen for no reason?
Well, the short answer would be both, but I think the deeper answer is that Gus is the way his son dies robs him of ever getting an answer to the question of why. Because there's no one for him to see about it. He's lost his faith in God. He lost his faith in God a long time before his son died. So it's not like his son died and he lost his faith. He, you know, cops, I find knowing a lot of cops, they either lose their faith or they're very faithful. And Gus is the guy who kind of lost faith in God long before his son died. So he can't seek answers in the church. He, as opposed to most people, when bad things happen, there's a reason. But Gus doesn't have a reason. Freak things happen, so there's no one for him to see. So, yes, he's a cop, so he's familiar with the kind of work a cop does, but he was never a detective. He was just a uniform cop. Mm-hmm. So he is searching for a surrogate or, proxy reasons why. So he can't ever find out why his son died. He'll never know. Yes, he had an undiagnosed, heart condition, but that's not really an answer. That's the proximate cause of why he died, but why him? Why then? Why his son? Never will know why. So his mission, or how I see him, is a guy who looks for the why in what happens to other people.
I see that, yeah. I almost hesitate to ask this, Reed. Is there any resemblance between you and Gus? He's been through some tragic circumstances, so I hope not. But
I think that's a fair question. It's a natural question. I've been asked it many times. Luckily, fortunately, I have, to this point, been spared a tragedy like that. I've lost people I loved. I'm 61 years old. My parents have passed away. I've lost friends. So I can imagine what that tragedy would be like. It is a job of a writer not to only write about what he or she experiences, but to extrapolate from the things they have experienced, to imagine themselves in other people's shoes. I think that's what makes for a good fiction, is a writer who can put himself or herself into other people's shoes and other people's positions. And so that's a roundabout answer to no, luckily this has not happened to me.
Well, good. Yeah. So another thing about Gus that strikes me, having to travel frequently for my day job, there's been many, many times I've been on the early morning shuttle to the airport, the only guy in the van, still dark, getting the first flight out, or in the cab to the airport. And, as long as there's no language barrier, having those conversations with the drivers, and those people have seen it all. And I love the fact that Gus drives the shuttle. I mean, what an interesting way to come in random contact with people who may need help. It, beats the cliche of the woman walking into the private investigator's office at the beginning of the book. What gave you the idea for Gus to be a shuttle driver?
I think what gave me the idea is what you just said. You travel for your day job, right? So you've been on those shuttles. And I tour a lot. And even before I was with a major publisher, I would tour on my own. And, you're at the airport, and the airport and the hotel shuttle driver picks you up, or the super shuttle driver picks you up. And what happens is, I'm writers are observers. You know this. You talk to writers all the time. So writers are watchers, and you sit in those vans, and sometimes there's eight people in those vans, and I would sit and watch the behavior, and inevitably there would be the chatty passenger, the passenger who was nervous or excited and who would want to talk to the van driver. And, of course, this is very odd, because chances are that van driver and that passenger will never see each other again. So it always struck me, wow, that's an interesting conceit to start books in a series with, is that, having somebody talking to the van driver. And it also comes from the fact that I drove a home heating oil delivery truck for many years on Long Island. And what what truck drivers learn and delivery people learn is that you're invisible to people. So it's a great vantage point from which to observe the world, because the world doesn't see you. So it's a very unusual thing to be both somebody people want to talk to, and then on the other hand, people no one ever see. If I asked you to describe the last guy who drove you in a shuttle van, you probably couldn't tell me what he looked like.
No.
Right?
And so, you never know who that person is, right?
That's right. So it is. I'm glad that you picked up on that, and several people have. It's a kind of unique way to start the books, and all the books do start that way.
It is, yeah. It works so well. You know, if there was a movie about what you break or where it hurts, who would be your dream cast pick as Gus Murphy?
You mean other than me? no, I'm gonna have to disappoint you and say that I really don't like telling people that, because when they read a book, I view writing as me giving my readers enough information to make the movie in their heads, so that I never want to taint their view of who Gus would be. I want them to imagine who they would imagine. And by the way, there is television interest in Gus. So.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
but don't tell anybody.
I won't say a word. It's just between the two of us.
Between us.
That's a good answer, though. I like that. So the setting of Suffolk County, Long Island. I've never been there, but it's a tangible place in this series. I would say the specific details, the weather, locations, etc. Doesn't sound a lot like the Long Island of F. Scott Fitzgerald. So why Suffolk County, and how important is setting to you and these stories?
Well, I'll take the setting question. Why it's important to me is I have an author friend, a writer everybody should know, and if they don't read, they should. His name is Peter Spiegelman, who, in my opinion, has written one of the 10 best private eye novels ever written, called Red Cat, and who is... his most recent book is called Dr. Knox. And Peter and I are very close. And Peter always says, setting is the soil in which you grow your story. And that, I think that sums up my view of setting. Setting is, it's not everything, but it affects everything. And I've always believed that if you could take a story or a character and move that story and character into any setting, you're doing something wrong, not doing something right. Setting should be so important that the story is somewhat dependent upon the setting. And obviously you've picked up on that, in that the Gus Murphy novels would not be Gus Murphy novels if they were set somewhere else. Why Suffolk County? I live there. and the thing about Suffolk County is, it is not what people imagine. Just what you said, it's not the Long Island that people imagine. When you say Long Island, even to other New Yorkers, what most people think of Long Island is the Hamptons, the Gold Coast, Long Island Sound, and Gatsby staring longingly at the green light at the end of Daisy's Dock. That's not the Suffolk County I live in. That's not the Long Island I live on. Where I live, it's thoroughly middle class, though there's a lot of poverty here. There's a lot of ethnic diversity here, though not mixed ethnic diversity. There's a lot of segregation here. And that's not anything people think about when they think about Long Island. I write about Suffolk because the Hamptons are in Suffolk County, but they might as well be on Mars for how much they have to do with where I live. So I think what makes for good detective novels, good crime novels, is conflict. And I think that is a type of conflict, the difference between wealth and poverty, the difference between ethnicities. And I think Long Island is actually quite rich in that stuff, but it's also something people don't know about. And so I got to be, you know, if not the first, I got to be one of the early people to expose those things to the rest of the world.
Rich soil indeed. Both titles in the Gus Murphy series, Where It Hurts and What You Break, carry some significant weight, I think, just in the words themselves. You know, they imply pain, you know, maybe guilt. Where did the titles come from, and what do they mean maybe in relation to the stories themselves?
Well, titles are important to me, and that goes back all the way to my poetry. One of my professors at Brooklyn College is now quite well known. His name is David Lehman. Said early on, if your poem is not important enough to title, well, you know how you get untitled poetry sometimes? Think he said, if it's not important enough to give a title to, it's not important enough to read. And in some ways, titles in poetry are first lines of the poem. So that's always stuck with me. And if you look at my 25 novels, you'll see that I love to have fun with titles, that titles are important to me. And I've helped several other writers title their books. But these in particular, I think Where It Hurts is the origin story of Gus's new story. It's where Gus, you know, stops being who he used to be and begins being who he is. And so Where It Hurts is that hole in his life, and out of which the new Gus will come. So that's what that title means. Where It Hurts is where the new Gus, who is evolving from his son's death, is coming. And What You Break, we've all been in stores that say, if you break it, you own it. And What You Break is even more meaningful title, because I won't give too much away, I hope, but there are two parallel stories in What You Break, and both have to do with deeds, crimes that have happened in the past. And the answer is, there's some people will take responsibility for what they've broken, and some people won't take responsibility for what they've broken. And so it's a story about people who have broken things and what they do in the wake of what the damage they've done. So that's the significance of that.
I couldn't think of two, just, you know, titles alone, better titles for a show called Noir on the Radio. What You Break, Where It Hurts, just fantastic titles. Reed, you've also written quite a lot of other things aside from the recent Gus Murphy novels. What would you like our listeners to know about, say, the Mo Prager series, if they've not had a chance yet to look into those titles?
Well, Mo, unlike Gus, Mo is more me. Mo is a Jewish guy from Brooklyn who didn't realize he loved being a cop until he wasn't a cop anymore, until it was taken away. And I think that's a very human thing. Sometimes we forget how much we love something, or don't notice how much we love something until it's taken from us. So Mo is a guy who's a cynical guy, who's a uniform cop, who gets hurt on the job, but not doing anything heroic. He slips on a piece of carbon paper in the precinct. And this is, for your listeners who have no idea what carbon paper is, The series begins in 1977 and ends in 2013. So it spans a great expanse of time. And Mo is a PI, a former cop, but he also is not a guy who's living hand to mouth. He and his brother own a chain of wine stores. It's a job Mo hates. He despises owning wine stores. But when he lost his job at the police department, he thought that was the way he was going to make his living. But what I love about the series is it parallels the time in my life. It parallels the years I've lived. So it shows you New York changing in those years from 1977, 78 to 2013. It shows growth and age in somebody. One of the things I love about detective fiction is the really good stuff, the more modern stuff, shows you the character evolving. I love to see growth in a character and change in a character. And the thing about the Mo series is, and this might be perhaps the only series that this is true, it was never hugely commercially successful, never hugely, but it was so well thought of, it was published by 6 different publishing companies.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating. And you've written a handful of novels featuring a much-loved character, especially by my wife, and I'm referring to Jesse Stone. And I'm curious, what has it been like continuing that series, which was initiated by Robert B. Parker? You know, how do you kind of get into that character? Did you talk to Parker, you know, Tom Selleck, read the novels several times through? How do you get into Jesse Stone?
Well, that's a really good question, and one I've been asked a lot. And it was a very fast, you know, I agreed to do it before I ever thought about it. Somebody offers you a gig like that, you take it. Then you worry about it. So the process was pretty interesting. And the first thing I had to do was decide how I was going to write the series. Because was I going to try and imitate the narrator, the Bob Parker's omniscient narrator voice? And I had a very interesting conversation with Ace Atkins, who writes the Spencer novels, and my friend, author Tom Schreck. And Tom is a huge, huge Parker fan. I had met Robert B. Parker only once at a cocktail party, you know, 13 years ago. We shook hands. He was having a drink. I was having a beer. And, you know, we were very he was very pleasant to me. But, you know, I'd never seen him since. So he passed away in 2010. So I didn't have the advantage of being able to discuss it with him. And someone named Michael Brandman had written 3 Jesse Stone novels in the interim after Bob's death. So it was a very strange transition because I wasn't taking over directly from Bob. I was taking over from someone who had already taken over from Bob. So I had a lot on my plate. And when I was speaking to my friend Tom Schreck, I, you know, and I was really puzzling over how I was going to attack the series, he said a very interesting thing to me, and I promise this relates, so be patient.
he said,
you know, Reed, I am a huge Elvis Presley fan, and I have seen all the best Elvis impersonators, all the best of them. And you know what? You can never escape the fact that they're impersonators, no matter how good they are. And there's also something they can never do. They're trapped. They can never do something new. And when Tom said that to me, I decided I'm not going to try and imitate Bob Parker. Because it would always be seen, I'd always be seen as an Elvis impersonator. I would always be seen as doing, no matter how well I did it, I would always be seen as never as good. And I don't think anybody takes over something to be thought of as second best. And so I thought I would serve the character and the series best by respecting the characters. I mean, Jesse is still Jesse. Suit is still Suit. Molly is Molly. And I will never change who they are in their souls. But I can't write like Bob Parker. So I write like a hybrid of Bob and me and what serves the characters well and what serves the plot well. And I think the response has been really good. Every one I've done has been on the bestseller list, so I must be doing something right.
Wow, yeah, and what good advice you were given there. Shifting gears a little, Reed, what does writing look like for you? Do you write every day? Do you outline your plots, or do you just kind of jump in and start typing away to see and see where the story goes? What does it look like for you, that process?
Yeah. I would say I'm a king pantser. I do it all by the seat of my pants. I've never really outlined anything in my life. Anytime I've tried to outline, I then feel like I've already written it. Why do I want to write it again? So I generally don't outline. And I enjoy just kind of following the plot where it goes. My theory has always been, if I'm not sure what happens next, and I enjoy it, and I'm surprised by what happens next, then the reader should be surprised and enjoy what happens next. But I've written 26 novels. The 26th will be out in September. It's another Jesse Stone novel called Robert B. Parker's The Hangman's Sonnet, another Jesse Stone book. So I've written 26 novels, and each of them, to be honest with you, is a little bit different. The process for each is a little bit different. Sometimes I know the ending and write to the ending. Sometimes I know the beginning and just go from the beginning. Sometimes I have, you know, a circumstance in my head and just try that out. Sometimes I know who the bad guy is and write from there. So each book is a little bit different, and that's what keeps the process interesting. I do write every day, no matter how much or how little that is. I try to write every day, even when I'm touring. I bring my computer with me. But now I have an interesting challenge in front of me. I don't know whether you know this or not. Do you know the movie Heat?
Yes.
Well, I was just selected by Michael Mann, the director and screenwriter, to write a prequel novel to that movie.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, so that is going to be that's an interesting challenge. I met with Michael last week, and his working process and my working process are a little different. I mean, I've done collaborations in the past. I've collaborated with Ken Bruin. Peter Spiegelman and I have worked on collaborations. I wrote a novel with a New York City detective named John Rowe. So I've done collaborations before, but I have never done a collaboration with one of the most respected directors in Hollywood. So that should be pretty interesting.
Well, that's exciting. So you mentioned the new Jesse Stone, the prequel novel for the movie Heat. What else is up and coming that we should be watching for? Should we expect more in the Murphy series in the days to come?
Well, I hope so. My agent and I are negotiating to do more Gus books because I love writing them. Readers apparently love reading them. Critics like them very much. So I would love to write more Gus books. My agent and I are developing a new character as well. I mean, I'm a writer. It's what I do. So give me a challenge and I'll take it. So, yes, I would love to write more Gus books, but I'm just they'll be I'll be writing until the day I die. So, whatever somebody give me a contract, somebody give me an opportunity, somebody challenge me and I'll write it.
Nice. Well, you've got some exciting things on your plate. So where's the best place where people can find you out there on the web and keep up with you?
I am on reedcoleman.com. Is very easily. I don't even use my middle name or initial for my website, so people can find. It's very simple. Reedcoleman.com. It's a really good website. It's got all of my books, all of my shorts, listings of my books, my short stories, my poetry, my essays. So anything, you can find me. You can buy books from it. I'm on Facebook. I'm happy to, meet new friends. I have an author page and a friends page, and I'm happy to speak to people and write back and forth. I'm on Twitter. I'm a hard guy to miss. So,
okay.
I always write back to people who write to me. So, I love it when readers write to me.
Well, Reed, thanks so much for coming on the show tonight and talking to us about your work. It's been a blast having you on. Would love to do this again in the future when your next book releases.
Well, Greg, you can have me anytime. In fact, I'll be on next Saturday. No, I'd be happy to come back whenever you invite me. I've had a lot of fun, and I hope the people listening to this enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. And for the listeners, I encourage you to check out Reed Farrell Coleman's Gus Murphy titles, What You Break and Where It Hurts. Check out the Mo Prager series. These are excellent works in the noir genre. Any of Reed's books, for that matter. Check out Peter Spiegelman. And while you're at it, keep an eye out for my upcoming release, Everglade. It's the fifth and final volume in the Selena series, and it's due out July 1st from All Due Respect Books. Until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.